It's me, Ellie Kroot. Back to you with Ellie 2.0 Radio. Hello. Happy Saturday. And if you're listening on Sunday, happy Sunday. Or if you're listening on podcast, happy whatever day of the week it is that you're listening. As usual, we have a great show for you. The big interview is a reprise of an interview I did with John Blake, the CNN columnist, last September about his book titled More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. Great interview, and you're going to get to hear it again today. And you know, my goal always is to have live witnesses, but some live witnesses. Oh, geez, there's the lawyer Nelly Crew talking. Live guests, but
as opposed to the witnesses not being alive.
That's right. Thank you, Brett, for that. You know, I was in the car listening about Donald Trump's upcoming trial, and I guess I'm just like in lawyer mode. Oh, okay. Well, hey, look, you got a great start to the show already. So the big interview is John Blake, and in the C block, as usual, I'll talk about my work as an idealist. Oh, we are off to a good start. But first, as we always do, let's talk about this week's featured idealist, and it's Pete Buttigieg, our current Secretary of Transportation and former two-term mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and former candidate for the U.S. presidency. Now, I originally highlighted Mayor Pete, as he was called back then, in early 2019. However, Ripple Newsletter, I have a newsletter, as you may know, and Ripple Newsletter reader Bernie Saunders recently sent me a clip of an interview that Pete Buttigieg gave a couple years ago. And that re-sparked my interest in this extraordinary idealist. And Brett's going to play a little bit of that clip of that interview in a minute. But first, let's get down to some of the basics. Now, this you may not know. Pete Buttigieg was born in January of 1982. So this guy is not, you know, not very old, okay? And he was born to parents who were college professors, both of them teaching at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend. Pete Buttigieg's father is an immigrant from Malta. Pete graduated from Catholic high school in 2000 as the class valedictorian, as you might expect. He went on to Harvard College and then later had a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford. After college in 2004, Pete volunteered for John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign as a policy and research specialist. After that, he got involved with some other political campaigns, for some folks running for office in or Congress out of Indiana. But by 2007, so this is not very long after he got out of college, he was a consultant with McKinsey and Company, you know, the huge, huge consulting company that operates across the world. And Pete Buttigieg worked on a variety of projects for companies such as Blue Cross and Best Buy and the U.S. Department of Energy and Defense. Now, in 2009, Pete Buttigieg enlisted in the Naval Reserve in Naval Intelligence. Now, you may recall that when asked while he was campaigning for president, why did he enter the military and do it fairly late in his 20s? He said that as he was knocking on doors to run for mayor in Indiana, you know, he would talk to families whose children were serving. And he just felt the need for him to go and serve as a part of his patriotic duty to this country. I mean, you know, so he was in the Naval Reserves for a number of years. And 5 years after enlisting, he was deployed to Afghanistan, where he worked in a counterterrorism unit that targeted Taliban insurgency financing. And he was in Afghanistan. He happened to be a driver for a higher-ranking officer. He called himself a military Uber. And he, you know, daily was putting himself and those in the vehicle with him at risk. Before that deployment to Afghanistan, in 2011, Pete ran for mayor of South Bend, where he was elected with 74% of the vote. He was later reelected mayor in 2015, that time with 80% of the vote. Now, You know, I mean, hopefully you feel great affection for Pete Buttigieg simply because of the person that he is. But for me, a queer person, of course, Mayor Pete represents the most visible gay person right now in the Biden administration. Now, Mayor Pete, you know, now remember, single child, so great allegiance to parents, Catholic upbringing, okay, think about repression, all right? He did not come out as gay until June of 2015 when he, this was after he's already served one term as mayor in South Bend, and he's running, starting to run for his second term, and in June of 2015, he comes out as gay. I mean, he then became, you know, he broke all kinds of rules and taboos in Indiana politics. But remember, he got reelected by a higher percentage in 2015 to the mayor post in South Bend. So obviously, residents of his town didn't care that he came out gay. That he became engaged to Chasen Gleesman, who was a junior high school teacher, in December of 2017. They married 6 months later, and then by September of 2021, Pete and Chasen had adopted two newborn fraternal twins. So they are going on, well, they're 3.5 years old at this point. What I love about Pete Buttigieg most is his intelligence and his ability to put forth reasoned and cogent arguments against the marginalization of people, particularly those from the LGBTQ plus community. I mean, isn't it kind of like sport to watch him, you know, take on Fox News hosts and other conservative hosts that try and tangle with him because he always wins? As proof of how smart he is, Brett's going to play a clip from a May 2022 interview that Pete Buttigieg gave at the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics. Now, again, I want to give credit to Ripple reader Bernie Saunders. I want to give him credit for bringing this clip to my attention. Now, it's a 2-year-old clip. It doesn't matter. It's very prescient to what's going on in our country right now. And I'll come back to you at the end of the clip. Go ahead, Brett. Go ahead and play it. It's about a 3.5-minute clip, everyone.
You have the agenda that has led to things like the Don't Say Gay bill, which, in my view, is a little narrower, though not less destructive, but a little bit narrower than the 40-year-long conservative political project that is culminating in what we're seeing perhaps about to happen to Roe. And what I mean by that is there's a more superficial political pattern that I think has driven some of the politics of the behavior of people like these people in Florida with the Don't Say Gay bill. And that is, when all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a culture war. So you got a political faction that really doesn't have a lot of answers for many of the questions that people are wrestling with. They love talking about gas prices, but they don't have an answer on gas prices. They don't have an answer on inflation. Many of them answered our call for bipartisan infrastructure work with a no. Haven't seen an answer on what to do about the price of prescription drugs. They voted against lowering that. Don't have an answer on what to do about the cost of childcare. Don't have a great answer on taxes. Actually want to raise taxes for the poor. That's a new one. I thought I'd seen it all. Then I saw Senator Scott's proposal to raise taxes for the poor. That's not great territory for them to be debating on. So what do? They find somebody vulnerable and pick on them, which at the moment is largely the trans community. And they find something to talk about which can go between the laughable, like, is Donald Duck going to make your kid gay, to the incredibly dark, which is the suggestion that the very presence of someone who is gender nonconforming or trans or gay or lesbian or otherwise different, that the very existence of somebody like that is an adult subject, right? That if my kids in, let's say, first grade classroom were to mention in passing that over the weekend they had a great time going with their dads to the zoo, that they would have somehow, by saying that, uttered something age inappropriate and get us really fired up about that fight. And it's just politics. It's motivated by just politics. So I guess what I'm saying is we're seeing a lot of overlapping patterns that are all pointing in the direction that the worst tendencies in human politics always have, which is to take rights and freedoms away and to make it harder for vulnerable people in the service of some imagined political gain. And there are two answers to that kind of thing, two kinds of answers, I would argue. One answer is to argue against it and fight against it, which is what I do, and people who are involved in politics and public life go on television and do. And the other is to see to it that that is, in fact, not a way to gain power politically. Because, of course, the biggest test of any of these tactics isn't were they well argued, were they convincing. The biggest test of these tactics is, did they work? And I'm going to be careful saying anything more about that because I'm here in my capacity as a federal official and I'm not here to talk about campaigns. But I will say just as a matter of policy and as a matter of the kind of political maneuvering that takes place among officials, certainly in Washington, ultimately, if things that hurt people help you get more power, people will continue to do them.
So, cogent, reasoned, truthful, scary. All those things that Pete Buttigieg just said. The worst tendencies in humans who seek power go after the weakest as a way to make their points made. Stuff to think about. And I hope that after the Biden administration, we hear a whole lot more about this idealist, Pete Buttigieg. Okay, that's the end of our A block. You're going to hear the interview of John Blake from last September. You're going to love it. When we come back, I'll do my C block. You're listening to me, Elie Krug, one of the relatively few transgender radio hosts in the world and the only one with a show about idealism. We'll be back in a second.
I want to hold the hand inside you.
These are the days. And we're back. Elie 2.0 Radio. Okay, so do as I asked, please. And go, you know, go check out Moms Demanding Action. Go do that because it's an incredibly important organization. Now, though, I am, like, totally psyched. Totally, like, on planet Mars because I get to reprise my older interview with John Blake, who is here in live, well, not live in the station, but online live to talk about his most recent book. John, welcome back to Elie 2.0 Radio. I am thrilled to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Elie.
John, let me just give the audience a little bit of 211 about you. So everyone, John Blake, and I'm reading from the official bio, is an award-winning journalist at CNN.com, the online site for CNN. He's the author of More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. That's where, and we're going to talk about that book that just came out in May. John has been honored by the Associated Press, the Society of Professional Journalists, the American Academy of Religion, the National Association of Black Journalists, the Religion Communications Council, and with GLAAD Media, from which he got an award. John, you are incredibly accomplished. You know I follow you on CNN. You write a great deal about skin color and disparities and the how we treat each other differently because of being other. And I wanted to have you back on because your memoir came out. Again, the title of the memoir is More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. And I wanted to have you on this station, on the show, to talk about your book. So, John, give us a little bit, if you would. Well, first of all, welcome back. Thrilled that you're here. Give us a little bit about the book, a little bit about the synopsis, and then I got like 5 million questions, most of which we won't get to. Go ahead.
Okay, so the story is about race and faith. It's kind of like a detective story, a little bit of a conversion story, a story about racism, and there's even a little bit of a supernatural thriller kind of, you know, tossed in. But primarily it's about me trying to understand my mom and her role in my life. And the reason I focus on my mom is because I had a really peculiar relationship with her. I was born in West Baltimore in the mid-60s when interracial marriage was illegal in much of the country. My mom's white, my father's black, and my mom disappeared from my life not long after I was born without any explanation. And so when I grew up, the only thing I was told about my mom was she's white, her name is Shirley, and her family hates black people. So the story is about me trying to find out who she was, who she is, why does her family want nothing to do with me because my father is black, and trying to find a way to reconnect with them and become a family.
And the book takes us on a journey. I mean, you are on a journey throughout this book, and tell us, give us the setting, okay, about West Baltimore where you're growing up, okay?
Yeah. So if there's any, probably one of the worst places in this country where you want to have a white mom is where I grew up. And that is West Baltimore in Maryland. And my neighborhood is notorious for several reasons. It was the setting for the HBO series The Wire, which was a series about how racism devastated this inner city black community. It was also the center of this really big racial protest in 2015 when the National Guard was called out and the city just shut down for 2 weeks. And that was called the Freddie Gray protest. Freddie Gray was a black man who died in police custody. Yep. So an environment I grew up in, it was all black. We hardly ever saw white people. And so it was very inconvenient to have a white mom. So I would not tell people that I had a white mom. I became a closeted biracial person. I was ashamed to have a white mom. I wanted nothing to do with her and her family.
Well, and I, you know, as I was reading the book, I was struck by the fact that you and I had, you know, polar opposites. I grew up in an all white neighborhood, out in Iowa. Okay.
You know,
without a single person of color in the whole, you know, 300 or 400 home neighborhood. You know, and so my experience with interacting with people of other skin colors was very limited. Although my father had a business, he ran an office, and he did have some people of color that would come for Sunday dinner, which was wonderful, which gave me my only experience. So, all right. So bring us along. Tell us how was it? I mean, you became interested in who your mother was, and you start down the journey of finding out some things about her that at first really put you off, but over time you softened.
Yeah, so I wanted nothing to do with my mom, but I had no choice when I turned 17, and that's when my father called me into his bedroom one day while he was watching The Price is Right on television, and he just asked me, "Do you want to meet your mom?" And it was a bombshell. I thought she had died, wanted nothing to do with me. So 3 days after that question, I was driven along with my younger brother, Patrick, to this really menacing red brick building in the countryside of Maryland. And I was told I was going to meet my mom. And we entered into this waiting room. And while we were waiting, we could hear people moaning in pain in the background. And we was trying to figure out where we are. A hospital orderly escorts this thin white woman into the room. She sees us, her eyes light up, and she says, "Oh boy, John, oh boy, Pat, it's so good to see you." And she comes up to me and she hugs me, and it's my mom. It's the first time I'm seeing her as an adult. And I didn't know what to do because I had never even used the word mom before. But I also felt uncomfortable because where we were standing, we were in the waiting room of a mental institution. My mom had schizophrenia, a severe form of mental illness. So she had been confined into that place for most of her life. And I don't know, I still don't know if she was confined there totally because of her illness, but also because of racism. Back in the mid-60s, My mom was Irish Catholic. What the church would sometimes do with wayward young Irish women who had biracial children, they would institutionalize them. But so that's the first place that I saw my mom. And what was significant about the meeting, besides the obvious one, is that it is the first time in my life that I felt empathy toward a white person. When I saw her, that she had suffered like this, I had never seen a white person like that. I didn't know that a white person could suffer like a black person.
Jeez. Well, and even more so, I'm going to assume you wouldn't have thought that because the stories that you heard about your father having interaction with your what would be your grandfather, your mother's father, okay?
Right.
Tell us about that because those were horrible interactions.
Yeah, so my father was a merchant seaman. He was a very brave man. He literally took his life in his hands, as did my mom, to date one another, as they did during the time. But whenever he talked about my mother's family, I just heard stories about monsters. When he first went to date my mom, for example, he knocked on her door, and her father answered the door instead, physically attacked him, called him the N-word, and called the police on him and had him arrested. And in those days, you call the police on a black man visiting a white woman, that black man could get killed by the police. So those are the kind of stories I heard from them. They were stone cold racist.
Right. No, and just horrible stuff. You know, when you were on the show last time, we talked about this concept of radical integration. You know, I call it the power of human familiarity, you know, but it's about exposure to other humans who are different than you. And then because we're human and because most of us have good, kind, compassionate hearts, we soften. Tell us about – so I'm going to jump around a little bit in the book, okay? And I want to come back. I certainly want to talk about Aunt Sylvia, okay, who just was so – I just saw you smile, okay? Yep. But you eventually make your way to Howard, okay?
Right.
You know, the premier, you know, historically black college in America. And you start to encounter other, you know, young black people – who have a whole totally different experience than you as it relates to interacting with white people. Will you tell us about that? And you know, and what I was struck by was because of the messaging that you got from society before you went to Howard was that you – and help me if I'm putting words in your mouth – but you started to think that you were not as smart as white kids, that you were not as smart as other people because of the messaging that society had sent to you. But tell us about your experience at Howard.
Yeah, Howard is like the premier black institution, premier college or university. To give you an idea of what it was like, Kamala Harris was one of my classmates at the time. And thing about Howard is I had to make a huge adjustment because I had never been around black people like Kamala Harris. In the world I grew up in, the neighborhood I'm known for, the neighborhood that I come from is known for its violence. You know, just tremendous violence. But what I say is there's another type of spiritual violence that you experience when you grow up in a place like that. And that is you absorb these lessons that you're not smart, that you don't belong, that you can never escape that place. And that's what I felt at Howard. It wasn't so much I was just intimidated by white people. I was intimidated by black people who were educated, who came from middle class and wealthy backgrounds. So that was one of the big adjustments I had to make. And I almost self-sabotaged myself and prevented myself from graduating. But in the end, I graduated from honors with Howard because I had a lot of help from really beautiful people.
So give us the years that you're at Howard, because I was
from 82 to 1987.
You know, I mean, that is not so long ago at all. And,
long ago, but yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the help that you got, okay?
Right.
Because you had an aunt, you know, I mean, your father was a merchant marine. And by the way, he taught you about radical integration as well, because he talked about being on the ships in World War II, where they were integrated, you know, and how, by the fourth, you know, voyage, everybody didn't care what skin color you were and all of that stuff. But your father was away a lot. And you and your brother, Pat, had to go and stay in, quote unquote, foster homes or all of that. And you had this Aunt Sylvia who came and rescued you. Tell us about her and the importance, because, John, I'm a big believer in having a mentor in life, having somebody that is your, you know, touchstone as you go forward in life.
Yeah. So I spent most of my childhood in foster homes because my father was away overseas, usually about 8 months or so out of the year. And my mom was absent. And so that was very difficult, as you can imagine. But one of the things that really helped me was that I had this aunt, my father's sister, who would watch me and my brother over the weekend. And she was what I call my lighthouse in a sea of chaos. She's the one that gave me books. She's the one that made me believe in myself. And what I learned from that experience is that when you're a kid and you're going through something like that, sometimes all you need is that one person who believes in you and you hold on them for dear life. And she was that one person for me and my brother, Patrick.
It sure sounded like, and you just made her magnificent. I wish I had had an Aunt Sylvia as I was reading your book. But I did also have someone. I had an Uncle Ed, and that was very important to me as well. So he helped me a great deal. Okay, so bring us along, okay? So you go to Howard, and then you end up eventually down in Atlanta. You meet another mentor down there who helps you with your faith and an understanding about God, Pastor Nibbs. Tell us about him.
So as I go from Howard and I become a journalist, there's a parallel journey. I'm starting to meet other members from my mom's family, other white members of my family. And these are people who I only saw as racist, who rejected me. And so it was very difficult as I began to meet them to try to establish a relationship with them. But one of the things that helped me is that I happened to join a church that was interracial. So as I was joining this church for the first time in my life, I began to become friends with white people. You know, I would pray with them, hug them, all those type of things. And what that did is that it really helped me also reconnect with the white members of my family, because as I started to reconnect with them, that Christian language of love, forgiveness, those kind of things, I know it sounds kind of sappy to some people, but that helped us find a common language and a common bond. And I say this not to proselytize. I'm saying that it was crucial that I was in an interracial community. It could have been a 12-step program. It could have been a bowling league. It could have been a military, whatever. But the important thing was that I had these close, sustained, authentic relationships with someone of another race. That was the thing that decisively changed me.
There's that radical integration again, right? It just really is. And so, so you're going through all of this process. Your mother had a sister.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about her, because she wrote you letters regularly. I mean, and you wouldn't read the letters. You just, because she was still part of that racist white family. Tell us about your aunt.
This is my Aunt Mary. And to me, she's one of the most important characters in the book. And she is the answer to a question that I've long had as a journalist who has covered racism in this country for over 20 years. I've often concluded, like, wow, I don't think enough white Americans can really change. And then I thought, wait a minute, look at Aunt Mary. Aunt Mary was someone who was unabashedly racist. When I met her, she didn't even see the need to apologize for not being in my life. But as time went on and we developed this relationship, a lot of it was through letters, then meetings, difficult phone conversations. She stopped being my enemy, you know, this white woman who wanted nothing to do with me, and became family, Aunt Mary. And this same person today is someone who has, like, Black Lives Matters, you know, signs on her lawn. She sends me books like The Killing Mockingbird and Right Fragility. She has really changed. And so it's taught me that we often see, I think sometimes black people see white people as you're either racist or you're not, and there's no in between. But people are complex. People like Aunt Mary taught me that people can change, and there's a lot of complexity. And so she's very important to me.
Well, and I'm watching our time here, John.
Sure.
Will you talk to the audience about I mean, eventually you and your mom became close, okay?
Yeah.
And all of that division, all of that separation ended. Tell us, how did that happen? And tell us about your mom towards the end.
Yeah, it happened through a lot of time. When I first met her, I was disappointed as a young man because first I was ashamed of having a white mother. And then I was ashamed of having a mom with a mental illness. But as time went on, I began to see that that person who defied her family and her community to be with my father was still there. It just took me a while to see it. And then we became extremely close, and she really helped me a lot. A lot of the pessimism that I absorbed in my job, she kind of erased a lot of that. Because to see somebody like that who has really been away from her family, who suffered so much because they chose to be with a black man, but yet they still have faith, yet they could still laugh at themselves, yet they could still sing. She became one of the most courageous people I've ever met. So, yeah, she's a huge inspiration to me.
Well, I just, you know, what your book is, John, it's just so touching because you just write it as a human. It's very, you know, it's just very down to earth. And we understand as we're going along that we've started somewhere. We know we're going to go somewhere else, but we didn't expect to have some of the, you know, stops along the way. What do you think? Let's just talk here from the macro perspective, okay? And what are you getting from a reaction from the public? Because what do you think your book represents right now in America in September of 2023?
I think it represents something that we rarely see in any story about race, and that is concrete hope. Not just kind of Hallmark card kind of hope, but a real gritty hope that looks at how complex people can be, that looks at how difficult racism, structural racism, all of it can be, but yet shows that people you never thought could change in ways you never expected. And that's my mom, that's my Aunt Mary, and that also includes myself.
Well, and so what reaction are you getting, you know, to the book? I mean, are you getting like a million requests for book clubs and speaking and
it's been really good. I'm getting a lot of requests. I'm supposed to actually go to I'm getting a lot of requests to speak. But the best stuff is when I go online and people are sending me emails. People who are so different from me come from very different worlds, but they're saying that I can relate to your story and I really felt it. And it's made. You know, you look at the news and you think the country's coming apart.
Yep.
But when I think there are a lot more people out there that have not given up on one another, that have not given up on this country, and are so exhausted by the divisions that they crave a real story about hope, not a false sentimental one, but a real one. And that's the kind of message I'm getting.
Well, and I hope you're putting all those emails in a special folder. I've got one. It's titled Good Stuff.
Okay.
You know, because I figure someday when, you know, I'm on my death, you know, last few breaths, somebody will be reading those to me.
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you? Okay. I mean, you continue to write about skin color. But John, the reason I adore you, and I'm telling you that, okay, is that you really always do look at the positive of things. You lay it out. You lay out the facts, okay? But you give us always a pathway on how to get past it. And, John, we need so many more of you. So what's next for you?
Well, thanks. I hope to write more stories like that because one of the things I learned from the book is that what I say is you can give people a book. You can, you know, give them how to be an anti-racist. You can take them to a protest. But nothing changes people like a relationship. Facts don't change people. Relationships do. So what's next? I hope to keep on telling those type of stories because one of the things this book has really caused me to relook at how I look at myself as a journalist. I tell myself, if I'm only writing about the problems, I become part of the problem. So what I hope to do is also write more hopeful stories that give people hope because I think we really need that right now.
Well, your book is it gave me great hope, and I'm positive that we'll give just about every reader that kind of hope. And, you know, you and I have talked before when we had you on the show. You're an idealist, you know, somebody trying to make a positive difference in the world. And I know your book is doing that, and it will continue to do that. Now, if our listeners want to grab your book, how can they find it? Just let's make sure that we get you a little plug here.
It's still in like the big, you know, the bookstores like Barnes and Noble, but you can also get it Amazon, a lot of online bookstores. It's pretty accessible so far.
Yeah, or people can do what I did, which was I went to my local bookstore and I asked them to order the book, even though it would have been way easier for me to go to Amazon and get it. But at least it kept the local bookstore in the loop.
I think I prefer that. We need independent bookstores. So, yes, they've been very kind to me. So, yes.
We absolutely do. Well, John Blake, it has been, again, an absolute pleasure to have you on my show. I will continue to follow you. You know that, okay? And, you know, I'm going to – I do want you to – hopefully we can work something out with all of my friends in Carver County, and we can get you online and do a book, you know, like a book club. That'd be something you'd be willing to do, yes, right?
Yes.
You know, and I don't know. Maybe I'll talk to my school district about having you come online at least, and because I think our kids – oh, man. I think our kids would benefit greatly from hearing from you. So,
well, thank you. And thank you for what you do. Just your community, your storytelling, being involved in politics, just caring and not checking out, you know, because of cynicism. So I appreciate that.
Thanks, John. I appreciate that as well. All right. Well, my best to you, my friend. Good luck.
Thank you.
Keep up the good writing and just be well. Okay.
Thank you. Too.
Okay, everyone, that was John Blake, who is the author of brand new memoir, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. I can attest to it. The book is great. Whoops. Make sure you go get it. All right, John, take care. Listeners, when we get back, we'll do my C block where I'll talk about my work as an idealist. You're listening to me, Ellie Krug, on Ellie 2.0 Radio. Bye-bye. We're back. Ellie 2.0 Radio. I hope you enjoyed that interview of John Blake. I certainly did. And factoid, okay, get it on your calendar. I don't have a specific date, but I do believe that the Carver County Library System, probably in Chanhassen, at their Chanhassen facility, is going to do a book discussion with John Blake. They'll do it, you know, virtually. But people can come live in the audience and listen to it happening. I hope that I'm going to be involved with that. I've offered up my services as a moderator. We'll see if the I was the one who got them in touch with each other, John and the library system. We'll see if they bite on that. But sometime in this fall, I believe that's going to happen. All right, C block. So I talk about my work as an idealist. We don't have a whole lot of time here, so let me just give you kind of the rundown. Tonight, Saturday night, I'm going to be speaking at the Delano High School in their auditorium to do the first two modules of Gray Area Thinking. It's in Delano, Minnesota. It is open to the public. The event begins at 7. There's going to be a queer choir that's going to do a show for a half hour, and then I'm going to do Gray Area Thinking, the first two modules, for about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes. So please come if you'd like to. All right. Secondly, next week I get to do some work. Okay. I get to do two conferences, not one, on Thursday, and then I'll be at St. Olaf University, St. Olaf College in Northfield on Friday afternoon and evening. Now that I think the evening talk probably would be open to the public, and that talk is titled A Target on My Back. It's about the how transgender people are being attacked. And, I mean, just as you heard from Pete Buttigieg, what's happening? The hammer coming down on the most vulnerable, and that would be transgender people. So that's going to happen this week. And But come May, my work drops off of a cliff. I might possibly have one talk in June compared to five last year, compared to 22 talks in June of 2022. People have become afraid. You've heard me talk about this before, and I will continue to talk about it. There are, I think, now 10 states that have outlawed diversity, equity, and inclusion departments and trainings and all that type of stuff within their state university systems, like 10 states. And there are more states that are debating legislation to do that. Florida attempted to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings and workshops for private employers, although a federal judge has put a stop to that and put that on pause. But, I mean, you know, it's I cannot fathom how different our country is today as it relates to me being able to go and speak to audiences about just about the way humans do marginalize other people and about our fear of other and how and of course, gray area thinking is a tool set on how to get past that fear of other. I mean, it is a positive tool set for all humans. It doesn't involve shaming. It doesn't involve making people feel bad. But nonetheless, those who are afraid, they stifle, and they're doing that. They continue to do it. And so we'll see what happens. I shudder to think where we will be a year from now if the election goes the wrong way. I don't know. Will LE 2.0 radio even be possible? I mean, hopefully, okay, but who knows? Who knows how badly it can go if 2024, November, goes the wrong way? So, all right. On that happy note, okay, I need to go. I hope that you've enjoyed the show. Big thanks again to my producer, Brett, who's always there for me, always doing math, always dealing with little wrinkles that I bring to him. So thank you, Brett. And to all of you, okay, you know, between now and when you hear my voice next, all right, after you tell everybody how great this show is, please continue to do that. But between now and when you hear my voice next, will you do me a favor? Will you go out and do something, small or big, to make the world better? Will you do that for me? Thanks. I appreciate it. Ellie Krug, LE 2.0 Radio, over and out.